You make my gray skies blue. When I look at you, I get a natural high. You're currently listening to W2ES featuring Tony Roberts with the tune Sky Blue, the TRP remix. Django Django before this was Slipstream from Off Planet. And we had ZOF before that with Do It For The Bit from Femme House Volume 2. Logic 1000 in that set also with Natural. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. Feel free to check out my website at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we honor Black History Month. At a time when the nation is confronting bold acts of white supremacy, violence, and hatred toward African Americans, we'll speak with two movement lawyers. First, we put a spotlight on an embattled civil liberties attorney in the UK.
Our guest, Fahad Ansari, is a senior civil liberties solicitor based in London who has been sounding the alarm about the UK's sweeping misuse of terrorism laws. Ansari's work exposes a shocking pattern of state overreach and embodies the courage of lawyers who continue to stand up to an increasingly irrational and authoritarian use of power.
We speak with attorney Mark Fancher from Michigan. He discusses the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and several cases that he has litigated while at the ACLU of Michigan. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Bogosian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. When repressive governments around the world attack their own people and liberal democracies fight back, some of the first responders are movement lawyers. Unlike cowardly law firms that capitulate in advance, as we've seen here in the United States, movement lawyers work hand in hand with activists, not merely challenging what the government is doing, but putting the government itself on trial. The roots of movement lawyering in the United States can be traced back to the civil rights movements of the 1960s and 1970s, where lawyers challenged laws that upheld segregation and other forms of discrimination. These lawyers use the legal system not just as a passive tool, but as an active agent of change. They helped litigate landmark cases that desegregated schools, secured voting rights, dismantled discriminatory laws, challenged draft laws, and questioned the legality of the Vietnam War. The founders of this program, Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, Michael Smith, Jim Lafferty, and Heidi Bogosian, my co-host today, are all prominent lawyers in the movement lawyer arena. But movement lawyers are not confined to the United States. Our guest today, Fahad Ansari, is a senior civil liberties solicitor based in London. As a movement lawyer, he developed a niche in representing individuals and communities affected by counterterrorism legislation, state surveillance, and discriminatory policing. His career has been defined by taking on some of Britain's most sensitive cases, including representing those stripped of their citizenship on grounds of national security, and representing Hamas in its 2025 application to be removed from the British government's list of proscribed terrorist organizations. The Hamas case resulted in Ansari being smeared by senior politicians and targeted by British counterterrorism police and the government agency that regulates the practice of law in the UK. On August 6, 2025, Ansari was stopped by officers at the port of Holyhead as he returned from a family holiday in Ireland with his wife and four children. Ansari said the bulk of the questioning was about Palestine Action, a group recently proscribed under the Terrorism Act. He was also asked about Hamas, but refused to answer, citing client confidentiality. Ansari said he was held by police for 3 hours, fingerprinted, photographed, and swabbed for DNA, and told to remove his face ID and PIN from his cell phone or face arrest. The following day, the contents of his phone were copied by the police. Ansari said at the time that, "In the decade that I have been involved in national security cases, I have never heard of lawyers in England being targeted to this extent because of their clients. Some have complained that representing Hamas brings the profession into disrepute. Yet what really undermines the integrity of the profession is when unpopular clients are unable to secure legal representation because of fear of public opprobrium and state intimidation." Farhad Ansari, thank you very much for joining us on Law and Disorder from your office in London.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm grateful for the space to have this discussion.
Well, no doubt, right off the bat, our listeners are eager to learn the latest about the repercussions of your detention last August, as well as the investigation by the regulators of the legal profession in England. Tell us about that, and how have you responded?
So let me start by saying that what happened last summer wasn't an isolated event. It actually sits within a recognizable historical pattern, one that you and your colleagues in the US would be very familiar with COINTELPRO and the smearing of the Guantanamo lawyers. In Britain, we've had it with the Troubles, with targeting of lawyers in Ireland. And in many parts of the world, where movement lawyers become effectively part of the battleground. I was detained under counterterrorism powers. These are extraordinary powers which are designed for the gravest threats. And yet they were utilized against a practicing lawyer who has a reputation for taking the government to account for its excesses it commits in policing and the implementation of counterterrorism policies. Now, what your listeners probably are not aware of, and I'd like to just educate them about the power itself. This is called Schedule 7 of the Terrorism Act. This allows the police to stop any individual at any border or port of the United Kingdom without needing suspicion, to detain someone for up to 6 hours and question them. And it's an offence, it's a terrorism offence not to comply with that procedure, which involves giving your fingerprints, your DNA, the pins to your devices, anything that they would deem to be refusing to comply is a terrorism offence. And people have been convicted of not giving their devices. Now, just imagine if someone was, if the police wanted to come to my house to search it or to my office to search it, they would need to go to get a warrant from a magistrate and to justify why they had reasonable cause to come to suspect me of a crime. Yet, the moment I'm in that airport, that ferry port, they do not require suspicion. And they can be as invasive as they want going through the entirety of my digital data. What's really troubling here is I repeatedly told them this is my work phone, this is a work device, this has confidential, legally privileged communications on it. And that's all they really were interested in, was taking that device off me. And it sort of suggested to me that was the real reason that they stopped me. In any event, I have challenged that. I've brought a legal action against the police and the government for what happened to me. The first question the judge asked the police was, well, why did you stop him? And they said, we can't say. It's secret. It's so sensitive that we cannot even say in open court why we stopped Mr. Ansari. I mean, I can speculate. I think everyone in the courtroom is speculating. Well, it's because he represented Hamas and you've been after him since that point. But they would not say in open court. And what happens then is they apply for this closed material procedure where they rely on secret evidence. So in that part of the hearing, I was kicked out of the courtroom. My lawyers were kicked out of the courtroom. And the only people allowed to remain were the police and the security services and the judge and their legal teams. And it's this bizarre scenario that until now, I have not been given the reason why I've been stopped. I've not been told the procedure for them sifting through my phone and accessing the data. We've just been told to trust the process. They won't access anything legally privileged. But how do I know that? How do they know what's legally privileged on my device and what isn't? I've got a list of contacts. How do they know who's not a solicitor, who's not a client, who's not a someone seeking advice? Why I might have carried out a Google search in a particular area? You know, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. I know where the pieces go. They don't. So how will they actually figure it out? So that case is ongoing. We're going to be going into the final hearing in May. And parallel to that, I've been the subject of multiple investigations by the professional regulator, which is called the Solicitors Regulation Authority, the SRA. So after the sort of news broke about our representation of Hamas last April, the Shadow Justice Secretary, a really nasty chap called Robert Jenrick, who spends his life complaining about lawyers and judges, he wrote to the SRA and urging them to investigate me for allegedly breaching the sanctions on Hamas by taking money from them. And the allegation is manifestly untrue. It's false. This case was entirely pro bono. And before we took instructions, we wrote to the Treasury Sanctions Department for guidance. We took specialist counsel advice. All accounts documented said that it's okay to work pro bono. You're not breaching the sanctions. And this was provided to the SRA, but nevertheless, they continue to have this very disruptive, very invasive investigation into me and my legal practice. Separately, we had Zionist lobby groups like the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and UK Lawyers for Israel complaining again to the regulator about stuff like that I supported terrorism just because I represented Hamas, that I presented a false narrative deliberately of the 7th of October, because I put in a witness statement for my client. I mean, that's his instruction, that's his position. Unless you suggest that I was sitting in the planning operation room for the 7th of October, I mean, how do I know if it's true or false, what he's saying? And then the most bizarre one was that I'm seeking to circumnavigate the sanctions regime by bringing this application, because if Hamas wins its case and is no longer considered a terrorist group, then it'll be free to fundraise in the United Kingdom for its activities. I mean, these are legally just completely illogical. It's madness. And yet the regulator is entertaining these complaints and putting me through a lot of turmoil for the sake of the state. I mean, one of the allegations against me, believe it or not, was I'm anti-Semitic because I questioned whether babies had been beheaded on the 7th of October, and I was told that this is akin to Holocaust denial. I mean, ludicrous. I mean, these things have been completely debunked, and I'm still being investigated for them. So, look, individually, each of these processes is framed as routine. It's a regulatory investigation every lawyer goes through. It's a police stop. It's not a big thing. You got a bit of smearing in the press. But when cumulatively, all of these things amount to a pattern of state pressure and intimidation. And obviously, we're human beings. We feel the pressure. But ultimately, our clients rely on us as the shield between the state and them. So we have to take it. We have to withstand it. And that's why we do what we do.
Fahad, what has been, aside from the regulators, the response from the legal sector, including the Law Society and your fellow professionals?
There's been strong private solidarity from many lawyers, academics, who understand what's at stake here. However, very few have been willing to go public with that support. Now, Recently, there was a letter that's signed by 100 lawyers reported in the Law Society Gazette, which was urging the Attorney General, the Justice Secretary, and the President of the Law Society to defend me, and more importantly, defend the principle that solicitors like me, lawyers like me, must be able to represent unpopular clients without fear of intimidation and harassment. There's been no response to that letter. The Law Society has been quite disappointing. I've written to them several times since last April, asking for a public statement, asking for a meeting to discuss. I mean, our firm was inundated with death threats, racial death threats. We had one of the state broadcasters, which is representative of the far right, GB News. They were telling people to come to our offices to find out what was going on, inciting that type of mob violence against us. And the Law Society until now has declined to meet with me. It said it cannot get involved in police or regulatory investigations. Yet, ironically, it boasts about how it intervenes on behalf of lawyers in other jurisdictions like Turkey or Iran or Russia, where lawyers are targeted by the police and their professional regulators. So it just seems that instead of defending the independence of the profession domestically, it's actually felt more like an omerta, like this code of silence that protects power rather than a principle. So this hesitation to intervene is quite revealing. There's clearly a climate of fear, and that's precisely why this matters, because the independence of the legal profession depends on lawyers being able to act without political intimidation. And until and unless the Law Society, the Bar Council, realize this, we are heading into very dangerous territory. Just last week, the BBC reported about how the lawyers for Abu Faraj al-Libi, one of the rendition prisoners, who the same lawyers represented Abu Zubaydah, who's still in Guantanamo Bay. And in Britain, when we rely on secret evidence, and like me and my lawyers are kicked out, we're given this special advocate. These are like security vetted barristers or specialist lawyers who are provided the secret material, which we can't see, but they're not allowed to talk to us about it. Now, in this specific case, the police and the security services raided the chambers, raided the offices of these special advocates, went into their safe, took out their laptops, and deleted all their files because they said they didn't agree to them being allowed to see this material, even though it's already been given to them. But it's that level of intervention which is unheard of. And again, there's one story on the BBC. A couple of legal commentators spoken about it, but generally it's not been discussed. It's like this is becoming normalized, and we are in very, very dangerous territory when that's happening.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde. My co-host is Heidi Boghossian. Today, we are engaged in a fascinating interview with Fahad Ansari, a movement lawyer, speaking to us from his offices in London, England. Fahad, recently, you and your colleagues transformed your London-based law firm, previously known as Riverway Law, into Riverway to the Sea. Please begin by telling us about the evolution of your law practice over the course of your career, what Riverway to the Sea seeks to achieve, and how Riverway to the Sea sees itself as different from the traditional model of legal practice in Britain?
Good question. So a bit of background. I grew up in Ireland in the 80s during the Troubles. So the Troubles being the conflict between the IRA and the British state. And during this time, many movement lawyers like Pat Finucane and Rosemary Nelson were vilified by the British government and identified with their clients who were members of the IRA. And that led to them being murdered by paramilitaries who were acting in collusion with the British state, something which David Cameron was forced to apologize for many decades later. Personally, my grandfather in Pakistan was a lawyer. He was imprisoned and tortured for his own political activism. And my uncle, again, was a lawyer who was arrested for his social justice work. So you could say it runs in the family. But the idea that law is neutral or detached from power is something I've actually never believed in. In terms of my work on Palestine, it goes back to about the year 2000. That summer, I was in university. I was actually getting ready to come to the United States on a student exchange program. And that summer, I was working double shifts at a gas station, including the graveyard shift. So I had a lot of time to read. And if you recall, at that time, the Camp David peace accords were in full flow. All the propaganda I was reading in the early hours of the mornings was about how the Palestinians had rejected peace. I really didn't know much about the Palestinian cause at that time. And then a few weeks later, I was on a plane to Chicago. While I was there, the Al-Aqsa Intifada kicked off. And now Chicago's got a massive Palestinian diaspora and community, and I found myself embedded within them, attending rallies, events, and also thanking God that we had the blessing of the internet, because without that, my understanding of the world would have been shaped by CNN and Fox News. So then when I came back from the States, I was really determined that my legal career would intersect with the Palestinian liberation struggle in particular. 9/11 happened. I became heavily involved in campaigning and advocacy work around the war on terror. And that sort of intersected with my legal practice. And eventually I set up Riverway Law in 2019. We did a lot of stuff, mainly around immigration, political asylum, and national security. But over time, more and more of my work, both in and out of court, seemed to become Palestine-focused, dealing with Palestinian citizens of Israel who were seeking asylum, Jewish Israeli citizens who refused to serve in the military, domestically challenging policies that served to repress Palestinian activism in this country. And then, you know, last year, we issued the application to deprescribe Hamas, which in one sense felt like the culmination of like decades of preparation for that moment. So last summer, after we launched the application and came under intense attack, let's say, we underwent a restructuring process and re-emerged as Riverway to the Sea. Now, traditional British legal practice is very hierarchical, it's very risk-averse, and often it's detached from the movement. It just seems to confine the terrain of the battle to the four walls of the courtroom. And they don't like to talk about what's happening outside. They don't believe in the court of public opinion. It's a very conservative way of looking at the law. And what my good friend and colleague Frank McGinnis and I, we said we rejected that idea that lawyers are these sort of neutral technicians servicing the power structure. So we wanted to build something that was deliberately different. And we're not a traditional city law firm. We want to integrate litigation with education, advocacy, and public discourse. We want to be on the front line training the activists. We want to challenge regulatory overreach and use the law both offensively and defensively. So I think that's an important distinction. Now, I just want to make very clear, before I get myself in more problems with my regulator, Riverway to the Sea, in its current manifestation, is not yet a licensed legal practice. We are still in the training, education, and advocacy branch, and we were in the process of creating the legal wing to carry out that strategic litigation to complement the advocacy work. But we're rather disrupted by the events of last August when counterterrorism police decided to stop me on my way home from Ireland. So that process is in place. It's not been abandoned. It's just been delayed. You asked me, Stephen, in the question just now about why we chose the word Riverway in our title. We did a lot of thinking around this, and we saw that rivers teach us about resilience. Rivers cut through rocks. They bend around obstacles. And they keep moving. They might go gently, sometimes they use sheer force, but they always move forward. And clients who come to us come in the most difficult circumstances, facing systems to them which feel immovable and completely overwhelming. So for us, we are their vehicle. Like a river, we commit to finding them a way through that rock. And that's the way we see our challenge, our struggle against the state.
That's really a beautiful analogy, Fahad. Can you please tell us about the UK Terrorism Act of 2000 and how it's been used to target political organizations, including Palestine Action and Hamas? What is the status of those two cases, and how have the UK courts responded to legal challenges?
The Terrorism Act 2000 is the architecture of oppression in this country. It is one of the broadest counterterrorism regimes you can find in the democratic world. From my limited knowledge of the Patriot Act, I would say that it's probably the British equivalent of that. And what it specifically does, I mean, it actually came in before 9/11. And it was a means of internationalizing the counterterrorism regime they had to police the north of Ireland. And so all of a sudden, we had all these emergency legislations that were in place to deal with the IRA and the Republican liberation struggle in Ireland were placed on a permanent footing and applied internationally. And groups from all over the world suddenly became proscribed or banned. Now, what's important to understand about prescription, and I think you guys might appreciate this because you still have some level of free speech in the US, which we don't enjoy anymore in Britain, because it does far more than just criminalizing membership of the organization. It criminalizes association, it has a chilling impact on free speech. Its purpose is to dehumanize and to erase the organization from the public conversation. So, for example, in the US, correct me if I'm wrong, but you can still advocate for the political legitimacy of an armed resistance group without necessarily committing a criminal offense. I think the red line for you guys is what they call provide material support. Whereas in the UK, even expressing an understanding of a group's motivations or methodology or reasons for their existence, that can cross into like criminal liability with up to 14 years in prison, depending on how it's been interpreted. You can't have meetings with anybody deemed to be a member of Hamas. And you can see the problems this poses when that proscribed group is actually governing an area such as the Gaza Strip. So that means the civil administration is Hamas. The hospitals are essentially run by Hamas. The schools are run by Hamas. The street sweepers are employed by Hamas. So if you go into Gaza, you will probably commit a terrorism offense through the week by coming into contact with any of those people. It's a terrorism offense to wear insignia that would suggest that you support Hamas. So we have a famous case of three Palestinian ladies getting convicted of terrorism because at one of the protests, they had an emoji of a hang glider on their bag, and someone complained that this was symbolic of Hamas, even though Hamas do not adopt that as one of its symbols. But this is where we are, I mean, in terms of prescription. It's designed for people to self-censor, to the vagueness of the law is exploited. People do not want to even have a conversation. But last year, the government decided to take this even a step further and prescribed a direct protest group, Palestine Action. For your listeners who aren't aware, Palestine Action was, before it was banned, a direct action protest group, and its methodology is to attack Israeli weapons factories operating in this country. So they will break into often Elbit Systems, who manufacture the quadcopters that were instrumental in the carnage and the slaughter of civilians in Gaza. They will go in and they'll smash up their factories. For me, it's the equivalent of somebody, for example, you had the tragedy in Canada today, the school shooting. And for me, it's like somebody going and disarming the shooter and taking that weapon off him. I mean, that person who disarms the shooter should be hailed as a hero. Yet in this country, people who go in and disable these weapons of mass destruction are deemed to be terrorists. And at the time, all sorts of propaganda came out that they're linked to Iran, that they're linked to Hamas. And just recently, the government's own advisor on counterterrorism has actually said that there is no basis for that. Now, again, Palestine Action have challenged their prescription in the High Court. There was a hearing in November. We're still awaiting the outcome of that decision. But I would be very surprised if they lost that. There's been such a huge reaction, public reaction. We have had over 1,500 people arrested under terrorism offences since the proscription for simply carrying a placard saying, we support Palestine action, we oppose genocide. And these are elderly people, a lot of them are disabled, and they're just taking this, engaging the civil disobedience because the British public has had enough to see where this is going. So it is really important that we litigate these cases within the courtroom, but we also engage in this type of civil disobedience, public advocacy outside. Collectively, that's what will bring change eventually.
As a follow-up to your answer, are you saying in the case of Palestine Action that any kind of normal trespass or vandalism charges would lead to minor sentences and would be an act of civil disobedience, whereas now it has been promoted into a violation of the Terrorism Act that could lead to incarceration for up to 14 years?
Well, not quite. So the group has been banned. Now, this is the interesting part. The group has been banned, but there are dozens of other similar groups and many copycat groups which actually emerged after Palestine Action was banned. And they are continuing to do the same activities. They haven't been banned yet, but they're still doing these activities. Now, the government is struggling because when these people came to trial, juries were refusing to convict them. Because juries saw that this is something, even when they brought the defense, that this is a political defense, judges tried to strike out the defenses saying this is not relevant. But jurors followed their conscience and were acquitting defendants on trial for this. So what you've done by banning the group is that even promoting their material, talking about what they are, again, it's designed to dehumanize and scare people. So many of the other groups now, people will automatically think, is this Palestine Action or not? Will I get in trouble? And yes, you will end up with 14 years in prison, whereas previously, trespass, breaking and entry, this stuff is not going to get you much more than a few months, if even that, in prison.
And the banning is a form of prior restraint because it's silencing the group even for its protected activities in advance. Is that your approach?
Absolutely. Not just that, but it's silencing anybody who might praise the methodology of that group. I mean, you just say that, you know, I really admire the way Palestine Action, you know, went in and disarmed these war machines. That would be potentially seen as you supporting a prescribed group and lead to you getting the police knocking on your door in the early hours of the morning.
Farhad, how can our listeners follow and support the work of Riverway to the Sea?
So we are on various social media channels. You'll find us on Instagram, on X, and we've got a YouTube channel, not on TikTok yet. Please follow there and please support us by donations. We want to try to keep our work as accessible as possible, but we can only do that if we are sustainable at the same time. We want to take on the state. It's dangerous, but we refuse to step back. As we said, if we're rivers, we don't stop because a rock stands in our way. We'll get around it somehow.
Farhad Ansari, I feel we just looked into the future of the United States, and it terrifies me as well. Thank you so much for joining us today on Law and Disorder, and thank you for the work you do every day.
I'm very grateful, and again, thank you for the time.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. As we celebrate Black History Month, conversations often drift toward a comfortable, sanitized narrative of progress. Our guest today, Mark Fancher, has spent his career in the uncomfortable spaces where the struggle for racial justice remains ongoing, contested, and for far too many communities, urgent. Mark recently retired as senior staff attorney with the Racial Justice Project of the ACLU of Michigan. But his commitment to justice did not begin there. A longtime leader in the National Conference of Black Lawyers and an active member of the National Lawyers Guild, Mark has devoted decades to challenging the systems that produce inequality. In Michigan, those injustices are often enforced by the badge. Black residents comprise roughly 14% of the state's population, yet account for nearly half of those incarcerated. That disparity isn't incidental. It reflects policies, practices, and policing strategies entrenched over generations. Mark has litigated the human consequences behind these numbers, from confronting a culture of brutality in the city of Taylor, which he described as functioning like an occupying army, to defending black officers such as Johnny Strickland, who face retaliation within their own departments for speaking out. Mark is no stranger to the friction that truth-telling provokes. More than a decade ago, at a Unity breakfast in Muskegon, his remarks about white privilege and police misconduct prompted audience members to walk out. He was labeled divisive. But as Mark reminded them then, and reminds us now, Dr. King did not preach comfort. He taught the oppressed to confront injustice without fear and without retreat. Mark, for years you have stood with those that the system tried to silence. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you so much. It's my great honor and privilege to be participating in this discussion.
Mark, looking back at the Muskegon Unity Breakfast back in 2010, why do you think the term white privilege triggered such a visceral walkout response?
Well, a lot has changed since that time. Back then, I think that the vast majority of people in this country, black and white, were engaged in some degree of self-delusion about race. They had not yet had the George Floyd experience. They had not seen the many killings by police. They had not witnessed a lot of the things that we have seen since then. And their expectation for an event like that, commemorating Dr. King, was to wallow in the sanitized memory of his dream of people holding hands and singing Kumbaya. And for me to come in and to talk about things which I think most people now understand was something of a shock for that community.
You've called that a sanitized event. What's the most dangerous thing we lose when we forget about Dr. King's radical edge?
Well, we really cheat him and dishonor his memory. Dr. King was a human being, and like all human beings, he grew, he learned, he evolved into a new person based on his experiences. And for him, toward the end of his life, he had reached a point where he began to recognize the fact his campaign against segregation was one which was in many ways in sync with the objectives of the broader capitalist class. They understood segregation was counterproductive when it came to profits. There were a lot of green dollars in those black pockets. They wanted access to them, and Dr. King's campaign to break down segregation was certainly going to give them access, and so they were completely on board with the idea of eliminating Jim Crow. However, as Dr. King began to press, as his conscience drove him to look in different places and in different directions for fairness and justice, when he began to call for an end to militarism, when he began to argue against the virtue of the concentration of wealth in a few hands and the need to eliminate poverty. This was in conflict with the capitalist agenda, and he became an enemy, and Dr. King was keenly aware of that. So that's where he was toward the end of his life. And if we don't acknowledge his progress in terms of his thinking and his analysis, then we dishonor him, but we also interfere with our capacity as a society to grow and to learn from him and to take the best from him in terms of his thinking. Actually, in reality, he was never a threat to white people. He was their greatest asset. The destruction of Jim Crow was beneficial to white people. The campaign that he waged toward the end of his life, the Poor People's Campaign that he was trying to organize, was one that was organized across racial lines. He sought to mobilize not only people in the barrios, he didn't seek to organize only the black people in the Delta. He sought not only to organize the First Nations peoples on the reservations, but he also went into Appalachia to organize on behalf of poor whites. He sought to bring humanity and prosperity and justice to all people in this country. And he was never a threat to them. He was a threat only to those who held economic and political power in their hands. That's who he threatened. And that's why he was demonized and ultimately killed.
Mark, let's turn now to a couple of the cases that you've litigated. One case was City of Taylor, ACLU v. City of Taylor, in which you compared the police presence to an occupying army. Can you share with listeners the facts of that case and then comment on how that mindset shifts the way a community views its own safety?
Well, just to be very specific and accurate about it, what we did is we put together a petition that we submitted to Biden's Department of Justice asking for an investigation of the Taylor police based on more than 20 different incidents of police brutality that we had been able to document. Later on, in an effort to follow up on that, submitted a Freedom of Information Act request to the City of Taylor for additional documentation. And when they stonewalled, that's when it became necessary for the ACLU to file a lawsuit against the City of Taylor in order to get those records. But the underlying circumstances of what happened there have much to do with the social and economic circumstances of southeastern Michigan. The city of Detroit historically had been a mecca for particularly black people who were fleeing racial oppression in the South. The auto industry provided employment and provided an economic base for the growth of one of the country's most prosperous black middle classes back in the 1940s and the 1950s. And it made possible things like the birth of Motown Records and any number of black political organizations and formations, and also the rise of black mayor Coleman Young, who used government in order to consolidate black power, political power, in the city of Detroit. This angered many in the white power structure, and they began a full-scale war against the city of Detroit. And that took many forms. It manifested in many ways, but essentially it involved white flight. It meant economic sabotage of the city. It meant economic withdrawal from the city. And it left the city of Detroit in a very bad condition. And ultimately, many black people were forced to flee. Those with means fled to suburban areas that were somewhat prosperous, but there were others who were poor or who were in the lower working class who did not have that option. And many of them left and went to small cities that are referred to in the region as downriver. And these are little towns which historically were populated by white working class people who had been there for any number of generations. And so then you had these black people from Detroit moving into little cities like Taylor, which is a downriver town. And these were people who were not necessarily committed to trying to establish long-term residence in those cities, but they may have been occupying rental properties. They may have been there long enough to stabilize their families so that they might move someplace else. And the local white working class populations in these downriver towns frequently regarded them as invaders. on an unwanted population. And the response of the police departments in these downriver towns has been to patrol these black pockets of the city as they would an occupying force. Their mission, as far as we're concerned, was to protect these downriver towns from these black invaders. And so it has been an environment which has given rise over the years to a tradition of police brutality, which is racially oriented. And so that's really the context of much of the violent activity that we were able to identify and which we complained about to the Department of Justice. We never did get a commitment from the Department of Justice to do anything. That has been our experience with the Department of Justice historically, regardless of who the president is. It ultimately came as no surprise to us, but what we did observe is that immediately after we submitted our petition to the Department of Justice, we were unable to identify any publicized incidents of police brutality in Taylor for an extended period of time after that. And we became interested in knowing why that was. We wanted to know whether Taylor Police Department had on its own decided to reform itself. We wanted to know whether they were engaged in these acts, but somehow it just wasn't finding its way into the media. And that's really why we submitted a Freedom of Information Act request asking for records that in any way reflected allegations or findings regarding racial profiling, police brutality, and that type of thing. And we ran into a stone wall. The city absolutely refused to turn over anything, claiming that they didn't understand the language in our request. And it pushed us to the point of having to appeal these denials all the way up to the Michigan Court of Appeals, where we prevailed. The jury awarded Johnny Strickland $150,000 in damages.
Mark, you also represented Johnny Strickland, a black officer who faced harassment from his own colleagues. What were the facts in that case, and what does it tell us about the difficulty of reforming police culture from within?
We regarded that case as a very important one. Johnny Strickland was a more than 10-year veteran on the Detroit Police Department, and he had gotten off of his shift, which ended at about midnight, if I recall correctly. He went home, he changed into civilian clothing, and he remembered that he had promised that he would pick up muffin mix for his mother. So he got in the car and went back to an all-night filling station that doubles as a package store. He drove into the parking lot, which was empty, but otherwise unmarked. There was nothing to suggest that anything unusual was going on. He got out of his car, and it was very dark, and it was very foggy, and out of the fog, he heard a voice that was cursing at him and telling him to get the F out of there. He turned around and assumed that, well, maybe these are kids trying to make trouble. He tells them, you know, listen, you really don't know who you're talking to, and you should just go your own way, leave me alone. And they kept calling and threatening and saying, if you don't get the F out of there, I'm coming over there and get you. And so he says, listen, you really don't know who you're talking to. So within a couple of seconds, a white police sergeant comes charging out of the fog, runs up to then Officer Strickland, grabs him, slams him against the car, puts him in handcuffs, and drags him off of the parking lot to several other white police officers who are gathered around a police car. He's told that there had been a reported hand grenade next to the gas station pump, and explained that that was news to him, that he had no indication. There was nothing blocking it, blocking the lot, or anything to indicate that it was a crime scene. And he explained that he was a police officer. to that, he was mocked and he was cursed at. They pulled out his badge and they laughed at him and told him that, you've been on the force for 10 years and you think you know every effing thing, and then they called him names and all of this. He was left with these cuffs on his hands, which were digging into his flesh. He complained about the cuffs being too tight. And finally, when a supervisory officer appeared on the scene, he asked what was going on. He told them to take Officer Strickland out of the cuffs, and he pulled him away, and he told Officer Strickland, look, this goes nowhere from tonight. You're not going to make a report of it. You're not going to say anything about it. His response was, I'm definitely going to report this. You know, I'm a black man, and they treated me this way, and I have a badge. He says, people who don't have a badge and who are black, any person, any average person, imagine the treatment that they're going to experience if they're allowed to get away with this sort of thing. I'm going to report it. And so he said, if you report this, there are going to be consequences for you. And so he says, there should not be consequences for me trying to make our force better. I'm going to report it. Strickland reported this to Internal Affairs, and Internal Affairs quickly turned around and began an investigation of him. They brought charges against him. He was disciplined and faced incredible retaliation over an extended period of time. And so we filed a lawsuit on his behalf, complaining about not only racial discrimination, but retaliation. The city refused to settle that case. We ended up having to go to trial, and fortunately, a jury was able to deliver some justice for Sergeant Strickland.
Mark, how has your leadership in the National Conference of Black Lawyers shaped your view of the law as a tool for liberation versus a tool for control?
National Conference of Black Lawyers, or NCBL, really had a profound impact on the trajectory of my career and on how I approached it. You know, I was an activist in college. When I was 9 years old, that's when Dr. King was assassinated, and that had an impact on my thinking, which I carried with me on up into college, as did my contemporaries, and we got involved in all kinds of things. We're agitating against apartheid, and in one demonstration, there were several of our members who were arrested. And when we were feeling that we were really at the mercy of the legal system, out of the blue came these guys from this organization called the National Lawyers Guild, who said that they were going to provide representation at no cost for the students who had been charged. I never forgot that. So that by the time I got to law school, I said, you know, I've got to join this guild organization. And I found out there was a student chapter at my law school. I jumped into it and I thought, well, this is where I'm going to find my opportunity to engage my legal career and my activism. And it proved to be true. I had heard about the National Conference of Black Lawyers, but I just always assumed that they were a career-oriented bourgeois legal organization. I really wasn't interested in looking that way. But they captured my attention when I read an article about how, you know, after I'd gotten out of law school, how this young woman named Adrienne Wing had been the delegate for the National Conference of Black Lawyers to the Palestine National Council in Amman, Jordan, back in, I believe, about 1985. And she, while going down the receiving line, embraced Yasser Arafat. Her photograph was captured doing that, and it plastered on the front page of the New York Post with screaming headlines about this black lawyer embracing a terrorist. NCBL became the target of bomb threats and death threats, and its funding was stripped, and all kinds of things were happening in retaliation for that. When Adrienne Wing was asked by the journalist in response to all of this backlash, what is the plan for you and what is the plan for NCBL? And her response was to the effect of, we're not backing down, we're going forward. And I thought to myself, that is the organization I need to belong to. And I attended one of their board meetings in Washington, D.C., and I was just absolutely mesmerized. There were these people, you know, I had been fangirly about so many people who had been practicing law, and all of them seemed to be in that room. There was Haywood Burns, there was John Britton, there was Chokwe Lumumba, there was Charles Ogletree, there was Margaret Burnham, all of these people, Gerald Horn, all of these people who I just admired, and they were all sitting here, you know, talking about how to struggle in the courts on behalf of the Black community. I was just absolutely intoxicated. And then to top things off, in the middle of the meeting, Decima Williams, who was the OAS representative for Grenada for the New Jewel Movement, came in and was very deferential and respectful to all of these people. And I thought, wow, that's Decima Williams. I mean, I was just blown away. I was walking on clouds for weeks after that. And I was absolutely committed to working with this organization. And I had the opportunity to become very close friends and comrades with all of these people I admired so much. And I learned so much from them. Most notably, I remember during that first meeting, there was a description about a political prisoner case that was underway where the government was really taking off the gloves and they were coming full scale against not only the political prisoners who were challenging whatever was happening, but also against the lawyers. And Haywood Burns says, well, we're not going to talk about how we're going to defend against that. He says, we're going on the attack against the government. And it was that type of a mindset which really influenced me in a big way. And I will always be grateful to NCBL for that.
Mark, does the annual celebration of Black History Month sometimes act as a distraction from the urgent ongoing civil rights crisis of the present?
I don't think so. I think that it is a nagging cue for people to focus on civil rights. How they do it may not be as informed or as effective as it should be, but there's always a guarantee that in February there's going to be somebody who's demanding that the country look at Black history, which is critical to the ongoing struggles that we wage in this country for justice.
Mark, I just wanted to add a comment to your answer about how NCBL inspired your work. I had the same feeling when I joined the National Lawyers Guild and met you, 20 years plus ago. Many of the guild members, including you, were people that I really looked up to. They were heroes, and to get to work and know them was an honor. We, unfortunately, are running out of time. Mark, how can our listeners follow you?
I do write regularly, and most of the essays that I write can be found online. I also have authored a couple of books. One is called The Negroes of Friends Village, which is a novel about 1968 and a small community in North Carolina that deals with a racial crisis for the first time. And then also, you know, another book called I Ain't Got Tired Yet, which is really based on my commitment to Christian faith and the role that it plays in the struggle for liberation.
Well, Mark Fancher, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today to honor Black History Month. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. It's been my honor and great pleasure.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law & Disorder, we welcome back award-winning journalist Paul Jay, who is working on a new documentary titled How to Stop a Nuclear War, based on extensive interviews with Daniel Ellsberg.
It connects the dots from the economics and mindset that drove the Cold War to the precarious state of nuclear policy today, including the recent expiration of the START Treaty. We then look at how neighborhoods within New York City are preparing to resist ICE raids.
New York City Councilwoman Alexa Villas joins us to talk about how her district in Brooklyn is organizing to protect itself against ICE.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. 2 weeks ago, we spoke with award-winning journalist and filmmaker Paul Jay about his upcoming documentary, How to Stop a Nuclear War. Scheduled for release in fall 2027, the film draws on in-depth interviews with Daniel Ellsberg and is narrated by Emma Thompson. It examines just how close humanity has come to nuclear catastrophe and why Ellsberg's decades-long warnings about nuclear policy and power remain urgently relevant today. We ran out of time in that conversation, so we're very glad to welcome Paul Jay back to the show to pick up where we left off. Today, we'll continue our discussion about the ongoing nuclear threat, how it's shaped by political and corporate interests, and what the public needs to understand in order to push for meaningful change. In addition to his work as a journalist and filmmaker, Paul Jay is the founder of TheAnalysis.News. For decades, he has investigated the inner workings of government, corporate power, and military policy, bringing together deep investigative reporting with a storyteller's clarity, helping audiences make sense of complex and often hidden forces that shape our world. Paul Jay, welcome back to Law & Disorder.
Happy to be back.
Great. Well, before I get into questions, on February 5th, that signaled the end of the New START Treaty. Can you just very briefly, before we get into our other questions, let listeners know what that means?
Well, in some ways, it's more symbolic than anything. The New START Treaty, which limited the numbers of nuclear weapons Russia and the United States had, and was more or less effective in reducing numbers.
I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh.